This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 19 for Thursday, August 6th, 2009.
Like a spot.
Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Music Store.
And hey, hey, the gang's all here for another edition of Out of Line After Hours. It's great to be here. I look so forward to doing these on Thursday nights. And, of course, joining me as always, Peter DeLorenzo, the auto extremist, exclamation point.
Yes, I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Well, I think your condition's doing pretty good.
Yeah.
As it always is on Thursday.
Still alive and well, sort of, yes.
Sort of. And we got some stuff that we got to get into on your column because you got some good things in there. And we've got David Welch here from Business Week magazine. Good having you here, David.
Glad to be here as always.
And the other David, David Kiley from Business Week. We got the whole Detroit Bureau sitting right here with us tonight.
That's right. And then last week someone asked if we actually have a Bureau or if it's people in New York rewriting press releases.
Here it is.
That's right.
It, man.
It's the
David,
whole staff. We're 24/7.
Great having you here for After Hours.
First timer, yeah.
I know, because we've had you on Out of Line Detroit a number of times and all, but it's great to have you here.
Thanks for asking.
After Hours.
Thanks for asking. I hope I won't embarrass myself or you.
This is where the real action is, this After Hours.
Yeah. Look, it's pretty hard to embarrass me, let me tell you. I've seen
or
it all.
Any more than you've done on your own.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he can only help. And we've got Kurt Ritter joining us from Saatchi, L.A. in L.A. Kurt, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
It's, you know, we got to set you up a little bit for folks who may not know Kurt Ritter, but you spent an enormous part of your career, most of your career at General Motors, at Chevrolet in particular, right?
Yeah, it's 32 years. You know, I left the end of April in 2003, so it's been a while. I never thought changing jobs once every 32 years would create any controversy, but it did.
Created huge controversy. GM hit the roof when you left.
Well, it was one of the unintended consequences of what happened. I never dreamed that anything like that would happen. You know, there's certainly not a handbook that I could refer to on how to do something like that. So it created a little controversy, but it's all over, and, you know, pleased to be out here.
Well, it's good to see you out because you kind of had to go a little bit underground there for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, I formed a company called Against All Odds Consulting. It's still a registered California company. And, you know, surfaced back, I think, probably three and a half years ago. Time flies. And now looking after both agencies, Team One, Rural Jewel, and Saatchi LA.
So, Kurt, what are you driving right now?
Just turned in a Camry hybrid for a LS460, Peter.
Okay. Just checking.
Yeah.
Just wondered if you might have gotten a new Camaro or something and didn't tell anybody.
No, but I saw my first one the other day.
Looks great. It looks great in the road.
Look good in California.
Yeah.
Kurt, you didn't want to get the EBX 250H or whatever Lexus is calling that?
Well, it's an HS250. It'll be launched here in early September. It is, you know, probably the most technologically advanced car that Lexus will be coming out with for some time. It's actually the hybrid is kind of the cherry on top. But it's a really neat package that it will have at a, you know, really attractive price point, I am sure. And we're really, really excited about doing the work on that. We really think that it will be as visually impactful as the Prius work that we did for at Saatchi LA. Really encouraged with how that work is developing. It's a great product. It's a great car. And it's a pleasure to be working on something like that.
Kurt, explain a little bit about what Saatchi LA is and what you're doing there. I mean, obviously, it sounds like you're working all the Toyota brands.
Well, we do, John. Both agencies, I would say, are full-service agencies. Kind of a throwback to the future, I think. And that media planning is still inside both Team One, that handles Lexus, and Ritz-Carlton. And Saatchi LA is dedicated to the Toyota division. But they both have media planning, which did not go away into some kind of a distant location that had to be managed separately from your creatives. And I know, Peter, you can appreciate this. Having media planners right next to creatives today is a big advantage. We do events and promotions. We have 3D capability in-house. We have media buying for everything other than the broadcast.
Yeah, that's great. So, Kurt, tell us about the new thing going on in Toyota and all the hand-wringing and rumors going on about Toyota bringing all their advertising in-house.
Well, Peter, hopefully it's you've caught up with the clarification from Toyota. Unfortunate that on July 28th, there was a press release that was really intended just for Japanese consumption and newsworthiness that was picked up by Agency Spy, and geez, within hours, it became a story worldwide that we're going to take their advertising in-house. The clarification has come from Mike Michaels, among others, that that is certainly not the case. It is really a reorganization of the department that they had called Global Marketing Division, folding in these wholly owned subsidiaries that they have over there. So it's all settled down now at the agencies. You know, today's economy is very tough, so people feel a little vulnerable and they hear something like that, and it creates some concern. But we think we've got that all under control now, and heads up and eyes forward.
Kurt, we've been hearing a lot from Toyota about, you know, the reorganization of the company, got some new leadership. They've talked a lot about needing to re-energize the brand, put some more passion into it. The ad that you guys recently did from Saatchi on the Prius, I thought was a really, really good piece of creative that was arresting and engaging. But the rest of Toyota advertising for some time, it always seems to me to be a company that is very reluctant to get too edgy or too engaging with its advertising. Is that changing now with the rest of the lineup? I mean, are we going to see edgy, engaging, more interesting ads on Camry and Corolla and products like that?
I think you will. When you get into these, you know, big volume vehicle lines, they're tough for designers and they're tough for creatives because they sell to this broad mix of people out there. But inside the Camry and inside the Corolla, there's quite a bit of youthfulness that we can bring out in those vehicles. There's certainly areas of the media plan where that's more appropriate. So I think, David, depending on the vehicle line that we're looking at, I think Yaris would be considered to be edgy. Certainly Tacoma would be in that vein. You know, I think the Prius, I don't know if I call it edgy, but it's visually arresting. So I think we'll have the opportunity to do that kind of work. It may not be in TV, in broadcast. But it certainly will have its place in other media channels that we have out there. I think the Corolla work that we did earlier in the year, you know, certainly had, it didn't have an edge to it, but it had a sense of humor to it.
Kurt, what's your take on where the ad dollars, where the spending is the most effective? You know, I mean, talk to us about the new digital stuff, some of the, you know, the social community websites and, you know, versus the traditional TV, print, that sort of thing. I mean, where do you see the most bang? Everyone's been talking digital for quite some time, and a lot more money's going there. But is that, do you get the bang out of it? Is it working? Or is this, you know, something where we could kind of see maybe a bit of a pullback and more money going back to TV at some point? I'm curious to know how effective that really is.
Well, I think TV gives you the reach. And when you're dealing with Camrys and Corollas that sell, you know, in the 350 to 400,000 range, it's hard to imagine that TV is never going to be a part of that media mix. I think, you know, if you just think about how we live our own lives here, you know, we live in both worlds. It's not like we go home at night and say, you know, tonight I'm going to, you know, go vegetarian and traditional media. I mean, we live in both worlds. And I think we have to, you know, provide content for both of those worlds. I don't know that print's going to ever make a comeback. So certainly that was one of the first migrations of the budgets that we saw moving from the print world. Sorry, David.
I was going to say, it's really good news for us, Kurt.
Yeah.
Thanks
for that. Moving into to more digital. But I think, you know, inside the digital world, you know, it's just not search and type advertising that's out there. That's a big part of it. That kind of came out first, came out of the, but now you're seeing, you know, branding effort that is going on out there. Some real live content that's out there. It's moved from the coupon clipping online phase to, you know, creative content phase. And I would not expect that to reverse itself as we go out. Now the social media is really just coming out of the ground. I expect that it will grow. It you know, since I've been around, the number one influencer in terms of purchases of cars has been word of mouth. And
I think it still is, Kurt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I
don't think we'll ever replace that.
So given that, social media gives you, you know, an avenue to orchestrate. But it is, you know, we're learning how to use it. It's not an attention kind of a medium where you, you know, hit somebody over the head and say, listen to me. You almost have to turn your brand over or certain elements of your brand over to the community and let them play with it a little bit. You know, we've done that with Prius. We provide information on events, ways to calculate your carbon footprint. It's more sharing and engagement than it is telling.
We call it the carbon butt print at Autoline After Hours, but that's okay.
Okay.
Hey, Kurt, one thing I'm fascinated about your commercials, this Prius ad that you've done that, as you say, it is visually arresting. Although I got to tell you, my daughter, who's 21, tells me it just creeps her out completely.
It's the ultimate shiny, happy, smiley car in the shiny, happy, smiley valley with the shiny, happy, smiley people.
You were part of the creative briefing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what I was getting at is, it's all these people in costumes. I mean, it's like
it's from the Olympics, the Olympics in China,
right? Or theater.
It reminds me of Teletubbies, actually. The whole,
but there's that aspect, and then with the Tundra ads that you guys did, mm-hmm. where you know they're driving up this big ramp, they're going off of this. It looks like a gangplank hanging over the Grand Canyon. Right. And what I'm getting at is this is all real stuff. In the Prius ads, it's all people in costume jumping around in the trucks. None of it's computer generated. And that's my question. In this digital age, this virtual age, why did you guys go out and do this real stuff?
Well, you know, going back on the on the Tundra, certainly in that category, it's been age old in terms of product demonstrations. And so, you know, you might say there's not a lot new. It's just how you do the stuff that's been done before in a new way.
But you can't fake that either. Otherwise, you get crucified.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It had to be real. I don't know if you guys are out there. My screen. Okay. Yeah, we're back on. But we had to be real. I mean, it was a very skeptical crowd that we were going to communicate to. So we had to do great pains to make sure that it was genuine, it was real, and you know, we had to pre-engineer all of this stuff. We didn't want to get out there in the middle of the desert and build these things and not have the truck be able to perform. So it was a lot of pre-engineering that went into it, some degree of risk, But there was a rational side we were trying to convince people of that we knew when they bought the Tundra. When they went to the diner the next day, they were going to be, you know, asked questions about why they did what they did. You know, and if the truck doesn't get respected, then you as a driver probably won't either. So we needed to attend to the rational side and show the components, but we needed to do that in an emotional way to break it through. So that was really the story behind Prius, or behind Tundra. On Prius, I think the visuals work in such a compelling way because they connect to the storyline. And that, you know, when we start with this, what we call a creative briefing process, it's by no means overly complicated. But when you come up with this notion that the Prius is an icon of progress and that it's the combination of man, nature, and machine, once you get that bought into, that level of conceptual thinking understood, and then you connect it with this visual platform that our new executive creative director put together, I think that's where the power, you know, begins to come from that communication, is that it's true to the product, the visuals support the copy, and it works.
Yeah, I want to go back to this thing that I've heard the Toyota executives talk about now a couple of times in the last few weeks about Toyota being, there not being enough emotion and or passion in the brand or in the product. Now, you're pretty wired in, and you're not just an ad guy. I mean, you were in everything. You were on the client side, and you're, you know, in product area and all that kind of stuff. So you're not the garden variety ad guy, and I'm guessing that you're pretty wired into these conversations with the new management. Share with us some of your ideas and what you've put out there in meetings about how to accomplish what they seem to be interested in terms of maybe changing or evolving the Toyota brand a bit here.
Well, to be honest with you, I'm still waiting to understand a lot of what our new president at Akio Toyota has in mind in terms of specifics and Yoshi and Naba. I think, you know, emotion can come from it can come from the way you bend the metal. It can come from, you know, the powertrains that you have, the way the vehicles are set up, the proportions of the vehicles, and all of that. You can get more emotion out of those. You know, I think, you know, you look at some of the Toyota product that's out there in, right now, and there is emotion. I think, you know, the FJ Cruiser is a good example of, you know, fun to drive emotion, you know, that comes out of that. You know, and in talking to the young designers about that vehicle, very interesting how they came up with that from the standpoint of, I said, did you look at it from a retro standpoint? And they said, no, we basically, it had not been in production for 20 years. So we assumed that it would be have been in production for 20 years and received updates every 5 years. So we went to that.
But you know what, Kurt, that's what all the guys who do retro design say. Oh, it's not retro. It's the natural evolution of what, you know, they said that on the Mini. They said that on the PT Cruiser. They say it on the FJ Cruiser. Everybody who does retro, the Camaro guys, everything, they
except
go, this
Challenger.
Is not retro.
Except Challenger. They really went back on Challenger.
Oh, no, they'll tell you that's not retro.
That's not.
They knocked that one off.
All I'm saying is the designers will tell you it's not retro, even when it is.
Well, it may not be retro, but it's certainly attractive, and I think
it's a great looking design. Yeah. But I think it is retro. It's not what you would say. This is the vision of the future of the auto industry. This is a recollection of a great vehicle from the past. And I don't know. You know, I know designers have a problem saying that something's retro because that means you copied something, and no designer will ever admit that he or she copied anything. But I don't think there's any reason at all to be ashamed of an FJ Cruiser or fill in the blank whatever other car being retro. I don't have a problem with that.
Is that product not going away? Have they made – there's either announcement or rumor about that, about the FJ going away, I think. I mean
– I haven't heard.
I haven't heard that. Kurt, in terms of styling, Toyota did a pretty good job of bringing out some of the emotion with the first XB, and then they sort of watered it down with the next generation. You know, but you look at Lexus, they've tried to make the car sportier. And they don't quite get where BMW is in terms of the passion and really bringing out emotion in the cars. I don't think you guys have done it all that well with the Toyota brand either, with the exception of Prius, which is sort of a different animal in and of itself. I mean, well, is the company just, and we're talking about product now, but is the company just not really willing to kind of to make a leap and really get something edgy in terms of either styling or really go with performance or something like that? They're sort of wedded to, you know, Toyotas are reliable, nice cars, and they kind of don't want to offend. I mean, I still don't see a lot of emotion and passion in the product itself, frankly. I mean, they're excellent products. People love them. I can't knock the company that way. But, man, I'm just not seeing the passion and emotion in the design or powertrains in the way you do with some other companies.
Well, I'm not as involved as David indicated I am in terms of their product planning and in design. I've been involved in a few things, but I'm not as close to that as I was when I first came in with Against All Odds. But I would say that the styling that you're going to see on the Avalon is still going to look like an Avalon, but it's going to be more expressive. As it comes out, I think to sell in large volumes, which is where I think you make a lot of money in this industry, as opposed to niche-y stuff, you are going to have to, you know, play to somewhat in the middle. But I think you'll see evolve over time that you'll have trim levels that will be more expressive. Now, I look back at the first generation Camry that I saw, you know, come into play here. And, you know, the SE model was quite frankly just a spoiler on the back. And now, in this generation that's now 4 years old, you, I think, have seen the SE, you know, become more expressive. It's not an all new brand, but I think utilizing some of the trim levels and tweaking the metal, you'll get more expression out of a vehicle. But I don't think you're going to see stuff that is going to not sell in high volume. I don't believe that you're going to see something like a Camry that, you know, become very, very expressive and sell in an $80,000 annual sales rate. Instead, I think we're still going to want Camry to be in that area of, you know, 350-400,000, and Corollas to be in that area. I think XB is a good example on Scion to be more expressive. So I think there's a time to be more expressive, and there's a time to do it with trim levels instead of base models.
So, Kurt, speaking of niche-y expressive halo vehicles, when is the LFA coming out, and how much is it going to cost?
Well,
John and I were just talking about that before we went on.
When is it going to come out? We're going to probably find out, and I'm sure Mark Templin, who you really ought to have on the show, can probably give you a heck of a lot more information than I can on that. I know they're going to have some updates coming here at a management briefing in the next couple of weeks, but it is going to be one great machine, and it's not going to be for everybody. From what I've seen, the pictures, you've seen it, Peter, it's going to be one hell of a machine.
When is that coming out, Kurt?
Pardon me?
When did you say that was coming out?
He did.
I didn't say. Ah. I know we'll get more information here quickly in the next few weeks.
I think we're going to see it next year. I'm just guessing. I mean, the thing ran at the 24 hours of Nürburgring with Akio Toyota as one of the race drivers in the race. And I got to believe if something's out on the racetrack right now this year, production can't be more than a year away.
Yeah, I'm not sure Lentz didn't even say at Traverse City this week. I'm not sure he didn't indicate that it would be sort of the end of next year. I thought he might have said something definitive on that.
So price-wise, Kurt, can you give us a hint? I mean, Peter said 100 grand. I said, no, it's going to be way more than that.
You know, I would be out of step and out of my element to be pricing out something that far out in advance. So I'm going to have to defer to Mark Templin and his bunch over at Lexus, which I'm sure they'll be coming pretty soon.
We should do a contest like we
we already talked about the next.
You and Peter think exactly the same.
The next Autoline After Hours contest is.
We had a contest. We had viewers pick how long GM's bankruptcy would take.
Oh, okay.
And a couple of people were like within a couple of days.
Oh, they were within one day, I think. Yeah. Or no, you're right. Two days
was the winner. Was 42.
Right.
It was 40 days.
So the next contest is going to be how much the Lexus LFA is going to sticker for.
Speaking of GM, Kurt, we're not going to let you off the hook. A lot been going on with your former employer. A lot about whether or not they can thoroughly change their culture. You were in that culture for 32 years. What do you make of this rapid restructuring of the company and what you've sort of read and heard, you know, from them about their ability to change the culture fast?
Well, I think, you know, cultures change when there's some real trauma. And I think they have gone through a very traumatic period. I think, you know, individually, they've got a lot of highly capable people. You know, I was with George Borst, a former Chevy colleague of mine who's out here running a TFS. And he asked me the other day, Kurt, are there any people working, still working at General Motors that we used to work with? And I thought to myself, and the answer is no. So I think this early retirement program that came upon, and I think Fritz is certainly, there's a lot of people that are going to be slimmed down. I think the big thing is, and it's not any different than what I run and what Fritz runs and others do, is these highly capable people, how they play together. Do they play nice together? Are they going to support each other? Are they urgently going to pursue the goals that that are laid out? I think there's a good chance that, given the trauma that everybody's been through, and understanding that there is not a third chance for this to work, I think the urgency is real. You know, the people that I talk to are feeling obviously vulnerable and uncomfortable. But I think you get change and you get culture change when you get trauma. And Lord knows they have been through one hell of a period of time. And I think there's a good chance. I mean, Brian Nesbitt, you know, coming over, that's a good culture change kind of move. When you think about taking Brian, a designer, and putting him into to this, that sends a signal to the organization. He's a very, very articulate man. If you were going to look at it and say, I want the new Cadillac buyers to look like this, they'd probably look just like Brian. So I think that's a good move that helps send a signal that things have got to change, that we would do that. First time I've seen a designer run a division.
First time I think it's ever happened in the industry globally. I don't think that's ever happened before.
Absolutely. Well, just the fact that Bob's there will be a huge change in that part of the business.
Well, it's a really interesting move because, I mean, and there were some sort of reasons in the background why. I mean, I was told his job was actually eliminated, but he's a talent that they
Whose
didn't want to lose.
Nesbitt's
design job was eliminated. But still, it's, you know, the idea of, you know, what have people criticized Detroit for a long time? It's not having product people in management jobs. And what they usually mean by that is an engineer with an MBA.
Right.
Now you're putting a designer in charge of a brand at GM and really one of the, you know, the most important ones that they have, because, you know, Cadillac has done some good products like the CTS. The new SRX looks very good. But let's face it, the momentum that they got in about 2003 when the CTS was doing pretty well, it kind of stalled out.
Yeah.
Well, I have a theory that Harvard Business School is what killed Detroit.
I'd go beyond Detroit.
To me,
anything to do with manufacturing in this country.
The fewer Harvard MBAs that they have running the divisions and brands and businesses in Detroit, the better off we're going to be.
Right.
Because...
But is that enough? And this is one thing I wanted to ask Kurt. I mean, you know, go back to, you know, Chevrolet for a minute. They come out with the Malibu. Terrific car. I mean, gets car of the year. I personally would rate it a little bit better than both the Camry and the Accord. And yet,
It's selling okay. The Impala continues to outsell it. The Ford Fusion continues to outsell it. Kurt, I mean, it seems to me they've got a sales and marketing problem, not a product problem.
Well, certainly the Malibu was, you know, a gigantic step forward. I mean,
yeah, but where's the sales? I mean, I agree. I think the product's terrific, and so I'm asking an expert in advertising and marketing. Isn't it that where the problem is?
Well, I would say that we, you know, I don't know all of the circumstances that would have been presented to, you know, Campbell Ewald, who I think is a very fine agency. We have a process here that we try to use that really, you know, gets at the guts of the product. When we launch a product, we call it a product essence. And we try to understand at a very, very fundamental level what all of these dimensional changes, performance changes really add up to. They can actually become overwhelming and distracting to the creative community. So we try to sum that up in a very simple way. You want to give your creative community, you know, I call it like pitching or batting. You know, your batting average when you got three balls and one strikes on you is a hell of a lot better than you got two strikes and no balls. So we try to put them in a position to win, to understand the product at a very fundamental level, and discover the truth about it. You know, we loathe about inventing the truth here. We try to discover that and then tell that in a very, very, you know, compelling way. It's often very difficult to figure out with a great deal of clarity, you know, did it work? Sometimes advertising can test out, you know, really well. And it, you know, you're happy about that, but things aren't selling. So John, it's a difficult, area to diagnose, that things can go wrong. You can see concepts sometimes that are at an early level of maturation that are not well understood, that are discarded, that, you know, could have been, you know, great ideas. It takes a great relationship, I think, with your client, to give you the freedom, at an early age. And I think Peter probably in his career was frustrated that, sometimes that, you present an idea, and it doesn't click.
Kurt? No. You know,
Kurt,
but I don't know the details of all of that. You know, I guess you can say, you know, if you look at sales, you know, did it meet expectations? And I, you know, would say it probably didn't, given what I've read. But, you know, the market is not, this is not an easy market out there that I don't know anybody's expectations that would be any more than 18 months old that are, you know, being met right now.
Kurt, I would argue that far too many of the campaigns and strategies that come out of Campbell Ewald and Leo Burnett, and before that, you know, McCann Erickson, they've been all over the place. They've been inconsistent. A lot of them have just been flat out duds. Lutz seems to be of the opinion that he's going to give them time, you know, time. I don't know how much time, maybe 6 to 8 months to demonstrate to him that they weren't the problem. He, when I spoke to him last, was very frank about, you know, we're a lot of the problem. The culture, the process that we have at General Motors for briefing the agencies and for approving work is broken. And I'm going to fix that fast. And it seems like he's going to give those longtime agencies some amount of time to prove that they haven't been the problem. Do you think that's the right approach? And do you think that his assessment is fair?
I think it is a fair approach, as long as it's implemented in a very fair-minded way. You know, I don't think Bob would say that if he weren't fully intending to, you know, give it a fair shot. I think, you know, creative is one of those areas that I've been, you know, looking at, you know, the top creatives, David, they don't appreciate brainstorming. In fact, I think they're lousy brainstormers. What they appreciate are fundamental understanding of the product, the fundamental understanding of the target you're trying to sell to, and a problem to solve, as opposed to, you know, freelancing. And so to the extent that, you know, Bob would be able to convey, you know, in a very clear-minded, brief way, I think, you know, the work should improve.
But Kurt, you ran Chevrolet when you had seven other brands to duke it out with for marketing dollars, advertising dollars, product money for that matter. Do you think that was part of it? I mean, this Malibu was launched at a time when GM had all of those brands. You know, they just recently got rid of them. They're really not completely gone yet. So is that a big part of the problem? They just didn't spend enough marketing cars like Malibu and Impala and others that are really pretty decent products, or in the case of Malibu, very good product, but they just didn't create enough noise in the market to really move the needle.
Well, that's always problematic. I think it's problematic in the industry, honestly, David. I think as we go through this correction, I think you'll see fewer, stronger brands emerge that will be, you know, better funded. So I think that was a concern that, you know, when you have, you know, limited budgets and you're trying to sell in big volume, that's not going to work.
Well, the Malibu was the first car that GM spent $100 million plus on a launch, like you guys do with just about everything you do. And, the fact that they did that, the old GM thing was they always had eight balls in the air and everyone was fighting for a piece. I mean, I remember when you were at Chevy, I mean, there was still a discussion about how much money Saturn was going to get or not get, and that it was time to pay attention to Chevrolet again. And here they were launching the Malibu and spending $100 million on it. And yet they still, you know, GM's perennial problem up until the big blow-up was they couldn't afford to do it anymore because they simply didn't have the cash. And I think the Malibu was probably the ultimate proof, and then they went bankrupt. You know?
Well, I was, you know, pleased to see that the brands are down to four, so that should be less problematic. I think, you know, by virtue of having four brands, it really implies that you will do highly differentiated product for each of those brands, and you will fund them appropriately and adequately to be successful. You won't. And I think in the industry, you can get in trouble if you confuse trim levels with brands. And you know, you put any amount of money, you know, behind something that's lightly differentiated, and you're likely to cannibalize one or the other. So I think, you know, I look at the Buick lineup, they're beautiful cars. It looks like that franchise has the opportunity to be, you know, independently or differentiated, but it will need, obviously, as all brands do, adequate funding. But in a four-brand scenario, it's a hell of a lot easier to come to grips with the reality than it was with the old GM.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kurt, correct me if I'm wrong. Were you not still at Chevy when the decision was made to name that car the Malibu?
We were. That was a decision that we made as a team. I think names are somewhat subjective after you sift through all the analysis. I guess the poster child for a name change would have been the Cavalier. You know, Cavalier had like 88% awareness and, you know, nobody liked it. It was basically to go forward with a name like that and to change that perception would have been like, you know, stupid. Kurt, so the Malibu had a rather neutral name to it, so you could take advantage of the awareness that you had with, you know, limited baggage to it. And you can correct that as opposed to coming with a new name that had, no awareness out there. So those are difficult decisions that you make. At the end of the day, they're somewhat subjective in what you feel you can do and what the new vehicle looks like as well. I mean, names are not going to change, ugly vehicles or mispriced vehicles.
Kurt, why didn't you guys pick Monza when you were considering Malibu?
I remember the Monza. I used to drive that in the company car in 1975.
Yeah, one of my high school buddies had one. No, I do have a serious question for you, though.
Or Vega.
My parents had a Vega. You talk to some people in the industry, Kurt, about how you bring passion out of a brand, and the idea of having some niche halo sports car or convertible or two-seat roadster or something like that comes up. And they always sell in low volumes. I frankly have never seen a brand turn around using one of those. It's always been something like how did Chrysler turn itself around? It was the 84 minivan. 86 Taurus did a lot for Ford. Lexus was built on the RX 300 being a big hit. These are all volume vehicles. I mean, the RX 300, certainly for luxury, big volume. Chrysler 300 turned the Chrysler brand around, kind of put it on the map. Again, high volume. What do you think of this idea of you can build a brand or you can draw a halo to it or draw showroom traffic or whatever with some small niche car that, 12, 15,000 people are going to buy? What do you think?
I think that's problematic. I think, you can do a better job. I think halo is different than island. Sometimes vehicles become, so unlike the rest in the lineup that they actually serve as somewhat of an island. I think Corvette is a beautiful, wonderful brand that has, but quite frankly, there wasn't a lot of connection between it and the cars that at least when I was there, that were being sold. So I think that's problematic if you go into this with the understanding that you want a halo and you're going to take some of these technologies and put them into the rest of the lineup. It has a chance of working then, David, but I think it is highly problematic to put something out that doesn't look like any of the others and expect that it will halo back and increase consideration.
Hey, we're getting close to when we have to do rapid fire, where we start to respond to questions and comments from our audience. But before we get to that, Kurt, I'd like to ask you, guys did an interesting ad. It's sort of a Yaris versus Yaris ad. And what I wanted to get you talking about is it's only 10 seconds long. And right. Talk about the compression that you've got to do in terms of getting the message across and yet still get the message across.
Well, in that particular one, John, that goes in concert with Prison Break on it's a mobisode that you could get on the web. So we had to be 10 seconds in length on that medium.
Hold on, Kurt, as you say that, because I think we can get Ben to actually play the ad. And so okay. Everybody watching can get an idea. You only got to wait 10 seconds.
Well, the problem that we had to solve, and that was what this creative was intended to do, is that we had a three-door and a four-door, and both, pretty well styled. But the three-door was going to sell in lower volume. But it had by far the most expressive personality to it. It was naturally kind of a cheeky-looking vehicle. So it was Yaris against Yaris. We created this contest that was out there so that we would get exposure for both the three-door and the four-door. An interesting vehicle. Before vehicles in that price range and in that genre were considered to be roomy, underpowered substitutes for used vehicles. You would gain a warranty with these. The Yaris, it was like the democratization of style at that end of the price range. And the three-door had this kind of really cool personality, so we wanted to have this face-off between the vehicles, and that was what that creative was designed to communicate.
So how, we all grew up in a world where you would see 2-minute ads, then it goes to 60s, and then it goes to 30s. Now we're at 10s. What's next? Ones?
Yeah, well, financing contracts went the other way, John.
two minutes. Are you going back to like Edward R. Murrow?
Yeah, no, I'm talking way back when. Yeah.
Well, I think you're seeing things become more compressed. We've done a lot of 15s. We did them when we launched Tundra, and they were, very effective. We were able to get multiple messages out there and tell a story about the truck. I think as we understand mobile devices more and more and more, you will see shorter bursts of communication that are more to the point and very clear. They won't have a lot of storytelling behind them, and narrative. They'll be more visual in nature. But I think you're getting more compressed as time goes by.
Good. Well, it's time to get to rapid fire. Can we get the questions out here?
Okay.
Ben, run the graphic.
I love the graphic. The rapid fire graphic rocks. Is this for a particular video?
No, Ben made this. All right. Here is Baldsack asks, I'd like to ask Kurt if Peter DeLorenzo looks like any shiny, happy people he knows.
Shiny, yes. I qualify for that one too, Peter.
Okay, Mike Scorodato, I hope I said that right, asks Kurt, now that you've been several years removed from GM, can we get an unedited perspective of what it was like during the Ron Zarella brand management era at GM?
Well,
no.
It was, you know, fundamentally, toward the end, not a great thing. Early on, I think everybody had hope that, we were going to do something pretty special. I'd never really had a lot of help from Ron when I ran the Silverado launch. He pretty much let me do what I wanted at the end. I think it became clear that you're not going to be able to fix what we had with communication. Communication, when done well, as I said before, discovers the truth about a product. It doesn't invent it and try and tell it. So best we fix products, and then, we can get great communication out of that. So I think it was a miscalculation in terms of understanding that communication could make average products, or sometimes just mere re-grilling and put a few soft parts on the vehicle, call it another name, and expect that with communication we were going to sell in high volume. So I think it was a miscalculation at the end, we were happy. I think we took some of the principles of brand management, which I think they're good. Actually, brand management goes back into product development. And you start right from the very beginning of what would I like to say about this product? What would my advertising claims be? I think, communication becomes a fundamental part of how the product is planned in the beginning. Then I think that's a good way to go to run a business.
Real good. We've got a phone question that came in via our private Google number. Nick Bean from Bellevue, Washington. Ben, can we bring that up?
No, I got to tell you, this whole cash for clunkers has just thrown a whole monkey wrench into the whole normal business course of people who need to be shopping for automobiles simply as a natural course of business. Inventories dried up immediately. There were fewer dealer deals there because they felt like they had a little bit more slush room with this whole cash for clunkers, certainly where the whole focus went, and indeed where all the money went. So now it's dried up new inventories, they really kind of borrowed from what would have been those future sales at the expense of folks who are out there earnestly shopping for a vehicle right now, but don't have a 25-year-old Ford Explorer SUV. So those who actually own cars here along the time are the ones kind of left out in the cold in terms of current inventory.
Well, I think the cash for clunkers, I think the hangover after this program ends is going to be massive. It's not only pulled ahead sales. Here we are for the last 9 months. All we've heard about the domestic automobile industry is they don't build cars anyone wants. They don't build fuel-efficient cars, which we know isn't true. However, And now Detroit has to get the consumers focused on the integrity of the products they're selling. You know, we all agree that has to happen. But here we are right back at it's a deal. It's all about the deal. And unless and until Detroit can get out from under that deal cloud, American consumers will never give the products their due. And it's really unfortunate. I think that's going to be a real problem in the aftermath of Cash for Clunkers. Yeah.
The 1 minute's up. Jan Allen at BMW Public Relations asks, this is for the Business Week Dream Team. What will be the main drivers of growth when we come out of the recession? What major consumer trends do you see in the market? Is it back to business as usual or radical structural change that's altering the automotive landscape forever?
Okay. I don't think something is going to drive us out of the recession quickly. It's going to be a gradual kind of crawl out and then walk out. People need to pay off a lot of household debt before they're going to buy stuff. That starts to generate jobs. So it's going to take some time. The trend, I mean, I think we're already seeing it. I think it's going to be here for a while. We wrote about it in our cover on boomers, but I think it's true for Americans in general. People are going to want value, something that, you know, looks good, feels good for the money. It's not necessarily luxury, but it sort of has, you know, the Target cheap chic sort of thing. I think that's going to be the driving consumer trend.
Kylie?
I think that I agree, and I'll add not only value, but products that have a lot of integrity and brands that have a lot of integrity. I think that the marginal brands that are already hurting are going to really hurt when people start coming back. The Mitsubishis, the Infinities, and things like those brands that just never seem to get traction. I think we're going to see a weeding out and a weakening of those, while Toyota, Ford, Cadillac, Honda get stronger and stronger, and Hyundai.
As far as BMW goes, they need to focus on what they do best and not spend a lot of time on not getting away from their core stuff. And BMW does that every once in a while. They go real good, and then they sort of veer off the road into somewhere where they shouldn't go. So my advice to BMW is do what you do best and don't screw it up.
Don't veer.
Yeah.
Okay, we got another phone question from Scott in Florida about Cadillac.
My question for Autoline After Hours is, pre the GM bankruptcy, the dealer lineup was Chevrolet, then Buick, Pontiac, GMC, and then Cadillac, Hummer, Saab. Now Pontiac, Hummer, and Saab are gone. Where does that leave Cadillac in its dealer lineup for the future? Thank you very much, and you put on a great show.
Who wants to tackle that?
Where does that leave it? Well, you know, for GM, Cadillac is at the top of the heap.
It's their premier brand.
It's supposed to be the, you know, they've always called it the tip of the spear. Now, to really be that, you know, they've got to add to this lineup. You go into an Audi, BMW, Mercedes, or Lexus showroom, and you've got a handful of SUVs, three, four, five cars. I mean, you know, now Audi's starting to splice the sausage up the same way BMW has. But, you know, these are broad lines of cars. You go into a Cadillac showroom. You know, my wife just leased a CTS, which I'll admit on air here. Terrific car. New SRX, terrific car. But you go in that showroom, the Escalade, they still sell them. Not really relevant. I mean, you know, for the times. They still have XLRs in there, even though they stopped building them. They have a DTS, which is sort of that's irrelevant for the luxury
buyer. Yeah, they got the CTS.
The SDS never sold.
Yeah, they got the CTS wagon coming and the CTS. Right. Coupe coming, they desperately need that, but
they need a broader line.
They'll have the Cadillac plug-in to add to the market.
They got rid of four brands. Right. That should exactly address the question that you raise.
Yeah,
it should.
Yeah.
Hey, we got a question here from Gene Halliday, our friend and colleague at Ad Age, who asks, Kurt, what's the biggest difference and biggest challenge you've had working on the client side before and now working on the agency side?
I love the agency side. I honestly knew it, Kurt. your life is different when you're on the client side. I mean, advertising, you know, when I look at the clients that I call on, who I have enormous respect for, and Mark Templin, Bob Carter, Jim Lentz, that, you know, what I do for them is a small part of their lives. They're involved in product development, pricing, dealer relations, and all of that. I get the opportunity to think, to surround myself with some really wonderful young people. The average age in the agency is 27. In fact, the other day we were talking about the changes in the future and who's buying what, and I told them, I was the only one in the room my age. I said, you know, my generation, folks, has contributed more to spending than any other generation in the history of the world. It's now your time to step up and start spending. Yet it's a wonderful time, I think, to be in advertising and marketing, content creation, whatever you want to call it. I love that world. I'm happy in it. It, to me, is, for what I enjoy doing, what I think I do well, I think it's a better match for me.
Good. And we've got another phone question from somebody calling in, asking about Toyota getting into NASCAR.
Yes, I'd like to just question with regards to Toyota getting into NASCAR, which I think is trailer trash racing. Was there any plans to get into the American Le Mans series and with regards to the success that that for example Corvette has with regards to the flagship and halo effect around the Chevrolet brand and the Corvette racing? Thank you.
Peter, that might be a better question for you.
They've been in NASCAR for some time, haven't they?
This is their, in Sprint Comp, this is their third full year.
Oh. Right, but he's really asking about Toyota getting into something like the ALMS. American
well, NASCAR. They should, and I assume when the LFA comes, Kurt, which we know it's coming, but you won't admit it. No, I expect to see the LFA in the ALMS. In GT2, or it'll be GT. You watch, you'll see it in GT. But I don't. Toyota has always wanted to become part of the fabric of America, you know, and that they've never made any bones about that fact. And they felt that NASCAR was going to get them there, didn't they, Kurt?
Well, I think going back to my days in Chevrolet, when we would do profit and loss statements on Monte Carlo. You know, we came and it was completely a losing model. And the brand manager came to me and says, you know, I get stuck with all of this racing on one line here, Monte Carlo, and we sell, you know, 55,000 of these things a year. And then he brought out, what is the composition of the NASCAR crowd? The NASCAR crowd was, you know, a heavy truck crowd that was out there. So when you look at it from the standpoint of, you know, what NASCAR could bring, it brings a lot of truck buyers. And certainly when we were launching the Tundra, it was a big help in that area. Certainly NASCAR being a part of the fabric of America was also part of it. Very true, Peter.
Yeah. Okay, Jim Haynes writes in to ask, Chrysler has said no matter who owns them, they want to stop making duplicate cars for the divisions. So which goes? The Caravan or the Town and Country? He goes on to say, we see about a 50-50 split between the two in our shop. I guess it's like a repair facility or maintenance facility. And wondered if they're going to have the same trouble GM will have with the Chevrolet and GMC truck branding with customers.
You know, I would say the Town and Country is going to go away if they're going to go down to one van, and they probably will. Look, the Chrysler brand itself, they've sort of been wondering internally, the Chrysler executives and Fiat, if they should keep it. And right now they are. They're going to try to make it work or see if it works. But you have two cars in that line that's selling any real volume. It's the 300 and it's the Town and Country. And, you know, could you just sell a very nicely equipped Dodge Caravan and get rid of the Town and Country? Yeah, you probably could. I mean, a minivan is enough of an appliance where, you know, maybe it's not that brand specific. You don't need those two brands. So, yeah, I would say if one's going to go away, you'd go with the Dodge.
I might go the other way and actually say if you're going to do away with the name, I might go keep the Town and Country, but I'd want to test it a bit. And even if you're keeping Dodge brand, call the minivan Town and Country, maybe. I don't know. I think Town and Country has a little more cachet than the Caravan does, but
Here's Joseph asks, why are there so many cars with only black interiors? He says, I know Detroit's freezing in the winter, but I live in California. It never freezes, but it's 100 degrees Fahrenheit with not a cloud in the sky all summer. He says, I'm not buying a car with a black interior. He's got a good question here. Why so many black interiors?
Because no one's thought of mauve. I don't know. Maybe designers don't get out of the upper Midwest often enough. Detroit executives have been accused of that. Honestly, I've never bought a car where you didn't have some sort of tan option, so I don't know.
You can get other than a black interior.
A lot of times, though, he's got a good point. The dash will be black, and maybe you'll get, carpet seat and that sort of thing in different colors. And if that's the case, it comes down to manufacturing simplicity. Keep it simple, stupid. Yeah. Run the car down the line. Try not to have too much variation.
Well, here's the tip.
I think the car company is getting kickbacks from the company that makes the big silver thing that you know.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Here's a tip. Order a white car. It's 40 degrees cooler. It's been proven than black surface temperature. And that'll help you a bunch.
Okay, we got another phone question here about the Like a Rock campaign, something I think Kurt knows a thing or two about.
Well, I have very, very fond memories about that. That was my first foray into advertising. As I look back on it now, I was honestly very blessed to have the late Don Gould.
Yeah, Don.
Mentored me. I came in February of 91, and it was right in the midst. I don't know if you can recall the mudslinging that was going on between Ford trucks and Chevy trucks, and Jim Perkins wanted to go in a different direction. So I came in February, and Don was the truck guy at Campbell Ewald, and we embarked on the next 90 days of our lives, and we visited with, engineers, dealers, and I remember one night we're having a beer afterwards, and Bob Obius was a part of that as well, Mike Ryan. And we talked to this one young validation engineer out at Milford, and we asked him what he was most proud of at the end of the day. And he said, when I go home and the Dodge and the Ford breaks down and the Chevy keeps going, that's a great day for me. we began to understand that, General Motors tested vehicles a lot. They had validation protocols that were very, very demanding of vehicles. We weren't the fastest. We weren't the most technologically advanced. But, again, the product truth of the matter was that these trucks were put together well. They lasted a long time. And I think that was when Don's mind probably, went into the creative world of, how can we communicate this? And it was some weeks later that he and Bill Ludwig came over and put together a Rip-O-Matic with that song. And, it was just a very emotional experience. You knew that that was going to be the answer. That we were telling a true story in a compelling way. And when advertising is done right, that's really the magic. And Don was also a very patient man with me. So I was blessed to have that experience with him.
Hey, we've got a copy of that ad. Let's run that right now, Ben.
America is still the land of rugged individualists.
Like a rock, I was strong as I could be. Like a rock, nothing ever got to me.
And every one of them demands something different from their Chevy truck. But they all want the same thing.
Like a rock.
The most dependable, longest-lasting trucks on the road.
Like a rock.
Hey, and we also got Kurt's answer without ever hearing the question. Can we run the question that we had the guy phone in on?
Sure. Yes, I'd like to just question you on whether or not you were involved with the Like a Rock Chevy truck campaign. And with regards to that, once that one was dropped, I think it was one of the most successful and longest-running campaigns ever. But yet when it was dropped, it seemed like advertising overall, generally over all the car companies, seems to have a dramatic change. And with regards to, maybe not using music and those kinds of things. Do you have any comments around that? Thanks.
I think you answered a lot of it, Kurt, but he's got a good question. What about using music like that in ads?
Well, they've used Mellencamp, in the recent years. I mean, he's really picked up the baton, like it or not like it. I prefer the Bob Seger stuff to the Mellencamp myself, but maybe they figure Bob Seger's a little dated now that he's in his 60s and playing golf.
Well, I think the Mellencamp stuff was a kind of a downer. Mm. You know, had a down tone to it. It was kind of like
brooding. Yeah.
Yeah. Bob had the Like a Rocket was a little more exuberant and passionate. And, you know, this stuff goes in cycles in advertising. You know, we don't have music, you know, and people lament that. And then some agency will light on some piece of music in the right time, the right product, and it's all hot again. So it goes in cycles. Kurt knows that.
I think it does, Peter. I think you're right. You know, I don't think you should ever use music as a jingle.
No.
As attention getter. I think it has to be integrated in part of the communication itself. And when a piece of music can help create that, then I think you seriously consider it. But I don't think you use music as you know, kind of a cheap attention-getting device.
Right.
Hey, Kurt, I got a question for you about voiceovers. Who's the guy who does voiceover for your Lexus ads?
You know, I'm going to mispronounce his name, Jim Sloman. I'm close, but yeah, he's no longer doing it.
He's no longer doing it.
No.
Oh, that's good, because I was going to tell you I find him really irritating.
Good thing you didn't get his name right.
Although I heard an ad today on the with that voice. So, who's going to be the new voice?
Well, we have one that's on there now that we have. I think we continue to explore, you know, various options. When our Chevy truck voice went away, we went into this period of time where we were experimenting. And, you know, that is one of the areas that is more difficult than I think one would expect, because a voice has to do many things. It sometimes has to tell a story. It sometimes has to announce in a sales event. So it needs to be, you know, seriously considered on how you can use it through the range of communication that you're going to need to over time. So at this point in time, I think we have somebody. We're obviously considering other options as time goes by.
Okay. Hey, we're coming to the end here, but at last week's show, Peter posed a challenge to Michael Benofsky.
Oh, no, he didn't find it.
Well, we don't know yet. Michael Benofsky has this amazing ability to just pull old ads out of I don't know where. And the only clue you gave him for an ad that you did was Python boots for a Trans Am. And I think Ben's got that queued up now, and we got to see, did Michael find the right ad?
Yeah, he did. That's the music.
It's amazing what's on YouTube. I mean, everything's on YouTube.
I know, but think about it. All you said was Python boots and Trans Am, and boom, he found it.
This is the classic boy drives across town to pick up girl story. Directed by Tim Newman. We had a lot of fun shooting that.
Only from Pontiac.
Oh, yeah, it was the 80s all the way.
Well, we're going to wrap up now.
The ads that, you know, get a little bit racy like that.
No, not anymore.
Hey, Kurt, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us for Autoline After Hours. It's been great having you on, talking about all the different kinds of things in the advertising community.
Hey, Kurt, you aren't related to Tex Ritter, are you?
No. I was asked that many times when I was a young district manager roaming the hills of Arkansas. And
you should have told him yes.
I was going to say, you should have said yes.
No, Peter, I'm not.
Second cousin, okay. Third remote.
Well, I've decided that Auto Extreme's just going to pipe in a Tex Ritter cut every time Ed Whitaker, the new chairman, walks through the Ren Cen to make him feel at home.
Okay, yeah.
In fact, we've got that.
Except we have that.
What?
I got spurs that jingle, jangle, jingle as I go riding merrily.
Yeah, Ed
along.
Whitaker, the guy who says, I don't see any need to move to Detroit. I live in Texas. I got to hand it to him.
Yeah, well, you got to hand it to him, too, saying he knows nothing about the car industry, but business is business. It'll burn.
Except that he thinks GM should stay number one, right?
Yeah,
good luck with that.
Yeah.
Kurt, it's great talking to you.
Thanks a lot, Kurt.
Yeah. David,
good talking to you, Kurt.
Thank you very much. And John, always a pleasure being with you.
That's great.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
We didn't even get into the weight creep rant I did.
Oh, I know. We didn't get into any of the news or anything like that. And what you wrote in your column.
Well, Reader was really incensed with me because I said that the SRX was too porky. It is, but they're all too porky.
They are.
And, I mean, we've seen this happen, and I'm blaming on the Germans, they started getting heavier and heavier to the point where people think 4,500 pounds is a normal weight for a vehicle. It's right. not, folks. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just happened in the last 8 years, you know.
Well, you know, I'm wondering.
Bentley weight at that. I mean, Bentleys are over 5,000.
What's the curb weight in the Audi Q7? That's because that to me is the.
It's 5,500 pounds.
I was going to say it's over 5,000.
That thing drives. Isn't that what feels like a Tiger tank driving it? And
isn't that what an Arnage weighs? Like 5,500.
Well, yeah, the Bentleys are over 5,000. You know, those kinds of vehicles. That's
but
one
Q7
thing.
Q7 is 5,500 pounds. I mean, I drove it and I thought it was heavy.
Cayenne,
is it really 5,500?
The Porsche Cayenne is 5,200.
Right.
Wow. Yeah. Now, you know, when you get into things like the SRX or even the Taurus at 4,000 pounds, that's a porky car.
Yeah.
Now, the only thing I wonder is that, again, if you're a Detroit automaker, you got all these legacy costs to cover, you try to make the product as cheap as you can. Well, guess what? You don't use aluminum. You use cast iron every chance you get. Mm-hmm. You use steel every chance you get. Maybe you go with high strength, but you go as cheap as you can. So I'm just wondering, Will the next generation Taurus be 400 pounds lighter, which would put it competitive with the Avalon and with the Maxima?
You're going to see them try to take weight out of that.
Well, yeah, but to meet these fuel efficiency numbers, right. They absolutely have to go lighter. I mean, they're not going to be able to get around that.
Right, but, you know, lighter, there's two ways to do it. Real clever design, and I mean real clever design, where you simulate the hell out of everything, and really, especially in sections of things, that's where you can. Or you spend the money and you go with
light. Are we still on, brother?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
because what I was going to say, this is funny. People haven't seen these vehicles yet, but the Indian truck maker Mahindra & Mahindra, which is probably, we think, going to launch their trucks here. I saw one of the trucks, or I sort of drove and walked around one of the trucks that they brought over, and I was astonished by the weight of the steel they used on the outer shell. It was like skid plate grade steel, and I said, "Well, we need to make them this rugged in India." And I'm like, "Look at the roads out here. I mean, Detroit's aren't great, but
yeah, let's not use our roads.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
But the weight on the end, they're like, well, it's very complicated for us to change the thickness of the steel. And I'm like, you're going to give away about 1,000 pounds on this. I mean, that you could put towards fuel economy.
We'll see when
they get here.
When you're going with cheap steel, you go with thick steel.
Oh.
You want to get thin steel that, you know, the high strength stuff or the super high strength stuff. You pay for it. And if you want to go to aluminum, that's another step up from there. You want to go to magnesium in not cheap steel.
But the thing that drives me crazy about the German manufacturers is they've got all that good stuff in them.
Right.
They're still having.
Right.
Where
is the weight? Yeah.
Right.
Well, you know, most German cars, you just open the door and the door weighs. You've driven the Volvo, and I know this is Swedish, but European cars in general are heavy as hell. Driven the Volvo C30.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The door on that thing.
It's a huge door.
It is a huge door, but I mean, you know, I'm not a little guy and I open the thing, like pulling that thing, closing it. It's like, I wanted to, like, you know, get a little winch on the dashboard.
Well, you know, that said, I mean, Mercedes-Benz classically, the engineers used to just do what they wanted, and then the marketers would have to figure out, but they would overbuild, over-engineer. And, you know, there was a lot to be said for some of those cars. They were beautiful. But now you can see in the some of the new Mercedes, not all of them. I mean, the AMGs are still good. But some of the new Mercedes where they're cutting corners left and right, it's not the same, you know. It's I wish that, too.
I mean, you know, we've got offset impact right now,
which we never had in the past. No, I know.
They've just passed strengthening up for roof crush. So that means the A, B, and C pillars are going to get thicker and stronger. You've got to put airbags, and now they've gone, you know, crazy with airbags. You know, used to have a speaker in the top of the dash. Now you got 14 speakers in some cars, and the list goes on and on. Now you got nav systems. Now you got this. You got, you know, power moonroof, and
I know how
it all adds up.
I know how it happened. Audi is now where Mercedes was. Audi is they engineer to their liking. And then whatever happens, happens. But they do some great stuff.
Chip's giving me a sign here. We're going to be at the AutoZone next week, and which is in Detroit on Woodward Avenue. And come on by and see us live.
Or not.
Or not. Right. And
There's the zone.
I wonder if...
With a Scarab out front,
which is
one of the coolest, most beautiful
cars ever built.
Well, it's like a minivan. I still think if you modernized it a little bit, you could come out with something like that today.
And you guys probably didn't hear this, but Fiat bought Bertone, and I've already said they're going to do some Chryslers.
All right.
So we're all waiting for the Chrysler Maserati TC.
I was going to say
2.0.
You know, I thought what was funny was the list of vehicles that qualified for clunkers. I was going through the list. It was either the list that they added at the last minute or they took off, and I was scanning, and there I saw it. The Chrysler TC was on one of the lists.
Chrysler LeBaron TC by Maserati, wasn't that the official name of it?
Well, Chrysler had a
Maserati Crown and
I had the porthole.
Yeah,
Maserati crest on it, if I remember
Chrysler,
right.
They actually owned a piece of Maserati.
Yeah, they did.
They didn't own it outright, but they owned
Didn't De Tomaso was somehow involved
in it? Yeah, De Tomaso and Lito were buddies, and that's how all that happened. That to me, that car was even more offensive than the Yugo. because
they knew better.
Yeah, they knew better.
Yeah.
Well, I heard stories of the Chrysler engineers just said, "You got to be kidding me! You want us to do this?"
And there's, by the way, there's a TC fan site I went to. I told Lutz about it, and he was incredulous that there was like 10,000 people, you know, registered on this TC fan site.
Well, it was all done slapdash. Hurry up! Do it on the cheap. And the car was terrible.
And then I think at the end, the cash to the dealer back on him was something like $15,000.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think they had one too many glasses of grappa while they were...
I remember writing about it on the site, over a wine-soaked dinner. Why don't we do this?
It was all very Italian.
Yeah. The other thing you wrote about was cash for clunkers, too, and the hangover when the cash runs out.
Yeah, I talked about it.
You know what? I will disagree a little bit on that. The cash for clunkers does have a definite end to it. They're not going to spend more than $3 billion or so. And I don't think it's so much pull ahead. We dropped so far so fast that I think what you're seeing in the marketplace is maybe a little pull ahead, but it's also a lot of people who just hung back. I mean, don't forget they announced that thing in March, right? And so there's a whole bunch of people that have been staying out of the market until that was settled.
That might have happened why June sales came in lower than May, is the cash for clunkers buzz was going, sitting on my hands.
For Detroit to make real product progress with the American consumer, somehow this idea that, well, I'll look at American car if the deal's right.
I think there is going to be some kind of hangover, and I don't know how big, but, you know, economists who are kind of looking at the registrations, analyzing some data, nothing's official yet because the data's a little murky at this point, but they're already saying that, you know, they don't think a lot of that many of these sales were incremental to the market. That it really...
Well, Jim Lance, and you heard Lance.
It's hard to define incremental at this point in this market.
Yeah, that's right.
Very hard, I think.
But just to give the full picture of the story, because I agree. I think there's going to be a hangover payback when the cash for clunker cash is gone. But
at the management briefing seminars in Traverse City yesterday, Jim Lentz said most of the people who qualified for cash for clunkers don't buy new cars. This was like a one-time, wahoo, let's get in and buy a new one. And look at all the cars that are the top selling, all subcompact cars. So, I mean, these are people for whom buying a new car is a big stretch. So what's selling well? Corolla, Focus,
Civic. Prius was in there. Caliber was in there, surprisingly.
Caliber. Hey, you know, Peter and I were talking about this earlier in the show. People seem to have missed that Chrysler had a fantastic July. But they still had a whopping big increase.
Well, I hope I'm wrong. I hope that there is no hangover, and I hope we just see a gradual increase.
The thing I look at is how much capacity is being taken out of the market, and if any of the forecasts are close to being right, that we're back on a 12-5-13 trajectory, you know, by the end of next year, this is not going to be much of a push market anymore for all those deals.
Right.
That's
what Lentz said, is that there's so much pent-up demand out there that even when the cash for clunkers, cash runs out, sales are going to continue to increase. I'm not sure I buy it because, you know.
Prices are going up in the next two to three years.
Yeah, and if we've talked about
and
that.
And people, if they need a car and they're hanging on to a 10-year-old car thinking they're going to run it, I mean, they might consider getting one now because.
Well, look, I keep saying by 2015, and I think this is an easy bet, the average MSRP is 40 grand.
I don't think it's going to be that high.
Yeah, what is it now?
26, 7?
Average 28 MSRP or 29, right now is 34.
34?
And the average MSRP?
We just had our Spinella on two weeks ago, right? Yeah. And Spinella said average MSRP right now today is 34, average transaction, and that's the one that surprised me, 29.
Okay, so that's what I'm talking about. Out the door, I'm at the 28 or 29.
Yeah, but MSRP, this is what I'm saying. MSRPs are in many cases, like Chrysler and GM, have been artificially high, and then they back out the price with the deal. What I think what you're going to see are prices. The pricing is going to really recalibrate in the next couple of years where you're not going to see $5,000 rebates. You're going to see a higher price and maybe, you know, cheap financing and, you know, maybe $500.
I think once the market really starts to pick up, they've taken so much capacity, to your point. They're running on such a low level of inventory.
Seller's market, man.
It's going to be a seller's market, and they are going to make big money.
Used car values are going to go up.
Residuals have been going up for the past few months.
Well, you know, there's a shortage of used cars, and it started before the cash for clunkers. Now there's a real shortage of used cars. But
actually, you know, some dealers were telling me that, and then I looked up some data, and it wasn't the used car fleet is getting thin, but telling me it wasn't a shortage.
It's coming, and it's coming so fast. I mean, I've talked to dealers from this area who are out traveling the country just trying to find used cars to buy to bring back to their stores here. Now, think about it. 2 years ago, we sold 17 million vehicles. This year, we're going to sell 10. So where's next year's nearly new car?
Exactly.
Where's the year after that? We're millions of units short of where we have to be. Millions. 7 million in this case. So there's definitely going to be a shortage of used cars, which means prices are going to go up.
Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and buy one now then.
Okay, let's go.
Help the Michigan economy.
Again, just to remind you guys, you know, for next week's Rapid Fire, you can always call us on our private Google line, 620-288-6546. You can always visit our website. We got all kinds of cool stuff that you can get there, hats, shirts, mugs. Just go to outoflinedetroit.tv. Most of you are there right now watching us live. You can always follow us on Twitter. We're at twitter.com/AutolineLive or AutoLine. You can follow Peter at twitter.com/AutoExtremist. We know that we've got, you can follow David Kiley at twitter.com/DavidKiley.
Yep.
twitter.com/DWelch47.
DWelch47. Okay, I'm going to have to write that down.
That's your porn name, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm right on the verge of
my solo piping name.
Okay. I'm right on the verge of pulling my Twitter. I'm sick of Twitter.
Okay, then we won't promo it.
Well, no, I haven't done it
yet. You haven't done it yet, okay. And, hey, join us next week. We're going to be down live at the Woodward Dream Cruise. I know the Dream Cruise doesn't start till Saturday, but believe me, it all gets going way before that.
Dream Cruise starts this weekend, actually.
Yeah.
Really?
But it hasn't started already.
This summer has blown by.
Well, thanks, you guys.
Sure.
Thanks for coming by.
Great.
Thank you.
Visit our website, OuterLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with OuterLine Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with OuterLine Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at OuterLineDetroit.tv. Orange, purple, silver, and blue, changes.